tell you right now, just by way of a disclaimer, this is not tonight for women and children. Shepherd is in a rotten, skunky, stinky mood. I have a cold, and as a matter of fact, I feel that colds were put on Earth for a specific purpose, for a specific reason, in spite of the Vicks Company's ceaseless attempts to eradicate it. I believe colds were put on Earth to occasionally remind man of his own mortality. That one step to the right, one false step to the left, and there is a yawning chasm into which you will go forever and ever, spinning end over end. What is it? What do they say? Spinning what over tea kettle? I can't remember the phrase. Is there anybody who remembers that whole phrase? I hate to have a phrase hang in fire here. What is it that you spun? Hey, come on, cut out the jazz. I'm telling you, I'm not to be fooled with tonight. If you're going to listen, listen. If you're not going to listen, get the potatoes back in your ears and go back to that crummy television show. Now, what is it they used to say that you fell? What was it, over a tea kettle? I can't remember. Ankle over tea kettle, I don't remember. It's a cold, you see, and I've got this cold. It's like that story on the news that Ted Malley was talking about tonight, that volcano. All right, we figure we got it pretty well fixed, you know, mankind. If we get the right party in, you know, everything will straighten out. If we get our particular ideology going, it's going to work. If we get everybody in the whole world thinking like they live in Westchester, the world's going to be good, okay, huh? Yeah. Then all of a sudden, the top of the volcano blows off. Burns everybody's tail feathers. Wish I could say what it is that burns on the radio. Everybody runs around. All of a sudden, they realize there is a yawning chasm there, boy. You know, I'll tell you, I have a little thing here. I suspect one of the reasons why writers who write out of New York City, Eddie, you never are aware when they write out of New York. I'm talking about New York writers. The only thing that a New York writer ever writes about is his own navel. Because the way New York is, you know, I'm talking about this city, the city itself, I'm not talking about the state of New York, you are never quite aware of the outside world. I'm talking about nature, the world out there, like the quicksand. I mean, if you spend all of your life living in Queens, all you can do is look at the walls and once in a while look out of the window and see the cabs go by, and then you wind up looking at your own psyche for the rest of your life. It's like, you know, it's like Salinger. There's no outside world in Salinger's works. There's only the tortured soul of some skinny people. And well, actually, you know, there is a thing out there. That top of the volcano is going to blow off, Eddie. And anybody like Peggy, you know, Peggy Fitzgerald, for example. Now, she's from Kansas. Now, Peggy has the look in the eye of somebody who has every third Sunday during the season nipped helter-skelter into the tornado shelter with the big wind just behind nipping at her bloomers. Well, you know, when you begin to have a sense of something else out there, you know, that goes a little bit further than whether or not you're going to make it with a chick, you know, or whether they're going to love you. The next thing you know, the big wind is going to hit, take the top of your thing right off, you know. Well, see, so it's a different attitude, different little thing. I suppose, being from the Midwest, I'll never forget the time. If you're interested in how you get this feeling, I just got to remind you, the world is out there. Have any of you ever seen a flood? I mean a real flood. I don't mean a big wave at Coney Island. I mean a real flood. I'll never forget that wave. It was I just made corporal. I remember I met her at Atlantic City. That's another story. We'll tell that later when the kids are in bed. It was a wild scene. I'll tell you, boy. Tell you. I learned there is a difference between the Army and the Navy. But nevertheless, it can't ever be sealed, the breach there. But I'm a kid, you know, and I saw this flood. I mean, you know, once you see a flood, you can't go back. You really can't. I don't know whether or not to tell you the story tonight of the big flood, or whether, to, you know, when you have a sense of the mortality, you have a sense of the sneakiness of it all, you know?
You can get water where there ain't any.
All together, gang.
can get these weathering.
All right, now listen carefully. Get these potatoes out of your ears. You won't hear this on Long John's show.
You can get sunshine always after the rain.
All right.
You can often find heaven without going above, but you can't get love when the rain and in love.
And you remember that. You put that in your thing and smoke it, Dad. I think we ought to repeat that last phrase, Eddie, just about the last 17 inches there, that's all. At 7.5. But the last 7...
You can get sunshine always.
You're just listening to this.
You can often find heaven without going above, but you can't get loving when there ain't any love.
You hear that? You won't get that out of Norman Mailer, boy. You won't get that out of Pfeiffer. That guy's laying it down there. They're beating the tom-toms behind him. I don't know whether to tell you the story about the big flood or tell you about the famous case of the disastrous book report, which was even worse. You know, a man only begins to understand this world when he has been really gotten, when he has been really put through the colander. You know what the colander is, don't you? Well, that's right. That's the strainer, Dad. And you only begin to understand this world after you've taken a few swift kicks in the tender spot. And furthermore, swift kicks for which there is no repayment. In short, defeats. How many times have you been reading? All right, I'll tell you about the great book report. You see, I'm this kid. You want to hear about it? How you wind up being a surly, rotten person? You wind up forever and ever and ever coming on after the last news broadcast of the day and before the scores. You want to know how you wind up like that, huh? Waiting eternally for the apples to ripen and knowing full well that when they do ripen, all you're bound to get are a couple of rotten old cores, a couple of cores. Yeah. Sitting here waiting all the time, always waiting for the great ship to come in. And when it comes in, what has it got? What does it got? A load of empty Coca-Cola bottles. Yeah. And there ain't a store in the neighborhood that gives you any kind of a... Yeah, that's right. Go ahead. Throw it in my face. Come on! Yeah. Okay, so I'm not Route 66. Yeah. Well, you're not Ben Casey either, Jack. Hear that? And listen, baby, you're not Debbie Reynolds either. Go on, laugh. Right on, Bob. What are you putting on? Snotty, rotten people. Okay. Blow the thing. Go on, blow it. Scared. See, you can't go and throw with it. Yeah, you Kleenex people. All right, cut it out. Did I ever tell you about my grandfather? My grandfather, when he suspected he was about to get a cold, would eat a meal consisting entirely of the hospital economy-sized bottle of Vicks salve on lettuce. I'm telling you the truth. He would eat, he would sit down, and he would just spoon it in like, you know, like you see the guys in the cafeteria spooning in the yogurt. My old grandpa would spoon in the Vicks. Boy, he would smell to here in Belmont Avenue and back again after it was through. His eyes would water, his ears would squeak. But the old son of a gun would pull through. He lived to 86. That's right. I'll tell you, he lived the last 4 years of his life on only one thing. On one thing. You want to know what it was? Jack Daniels and Hattacall. Yeah, he used to make a martini, a Manhattan out of Hattacall. And Jack, well, it's a long story. But that's another long story. It goes on and on and on. You know. Speaking of getting back to the conditions of about our world, I'll tell you. I'm this kid. See, we'll learn about that. My father was a collector of old rotten books. He was a typical guy who read. You know, but he just read. He didn't know what was good books and what were bad books. He just read books. You know, and so you would find in his collection of books, you would find the Canary Murder case. Cheek by jowl with Gibbon. And right next to Gibbon, you would find Jimmy Dale, The Gray Seal Strikes Back. That's right. All kinds of stuff. See, and I'm a kid, and I'm just beginning to get interested in reading. I had gotten out of the little, probably the Little Orphan Annie Big Little Book stage, you know, and I'd gone through Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy, and the Outdoor Chums were beginning to pall, and I'm about, you know, I'm in sixth grade. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, because Miss Robinette, who was a sixth grade teacher, played a very, very stirring role in this drama. Miss Robinette was one of those people who, well, now, I suppose if I saw her today, I would say she had a secret sorrow. But then I just thought, you know, she was sort of like Merle Oberon or somebody. She had the look in the eye, and she was just a fantastic chick. I mean, you know how a kid falls madly in love with a teacher for a while there? Well, that was Miss Robinette. She was dark and beautiful, just a beautiful woman. And it was one of the very few teachers who took a liking to me right away. There's something in my eye. I don't know what it is. It's just the look in my eye. I have never been liked by program directors. Anybody in power never likes me automatically. There's a thing in my eye. It looks like I'm going to, I don't know, shoot a Roman candle into the hot air register or something. I don't know. Just the look. And I want to sell out. I want to do anything they want me to do. Just tell me, I'll do it, you know. But they don't believe it. So, you take the other course. But nevertheless, Miss Robinette, we had just gotten into the stage, you know, where kids are starting to do book reports. Well, so I'm going to the library, and I'm getting out the books. I'd take a book, and I'd read it. You know, a book like Robinson Crusoe. All right, so I read Robinson Crusoe. It's about this guy on this island, and he makes this hat out of coconut shells. And I'm writing this. And you make a book report, which consists mainly of just saying what the book was about, you know, and drawing some pretty vapid conclusions. Like, it is a very interesting book. That kind of summation, see. And you figure you're really saying something great about the book. Or, I found this book very exciting. That kind of thing. So, one day I am going through the bookshelves, and there were some books, you see, that my father, for some reason or other, kept in his room. Yes. Well, of course, at that point, I did not know about them books, using the vernacular of the period. So, one day, no one's home, I'm looking for a book to read for the book report, and I came across this big, thick, green book with a wild name. Some foreign name, you know. And in those days, anything that was foreign sounded like very important. And so I started to read this book. It was a big, thick, it was 3 inches thick. Big, fat pages, and it had pictures in it. That's the first thing that got me. I'm looking at the pictures, and the pictures were very interesting. They were like woodcuts, Ed. And I'm going through reading the book, you know, first by pictures, and then I start reading the stories. Well, now, they were very interesting stories. All I can tell you was that I couldn't quite figure out what they were about. Like, there would be one about this friar. Well, I didn't quite know what a friar was. I mean, you know, they don't really explain to you in Robin Hood what friars are. Well, it was about the friar. Then there would be one about an abbey. These people were in this abbey, and there was a guy named the abbot. And I didn't know what that was about. And then there would be somebody called the abbess. I couldn't figure out what one of these people were, you see. And there was something like about the count. And I'm reading all these little stories with pictures. But there was something about the stories and the pictures combined that made me continue like a nut. I read this entire book. And you know how kids are, you know, you get hung. I read this book like night and day till my eyes were popping out. And every time, and there was also something sneaky in me that told me that there was something not quite right about reading this book, so I only read it when nobody was around. I would go nipping in there when people would be out, and I'd go right back, and I'd start to read it. You know? Speaking of sneakiness, this is WORAM at FM New Yorky. Okay, let it warm up. So being hung on this book, I kept reading this, and I began to get the idea, well, this is a very important book because they're talking in Italian, and there's all kinds of Italian stuff in there. And it's about castles, and they have moats, it's very great, you know, it's a very exciting book. But I can't quite figure out that the stories, Eddie, would always just sort of fiddle out, you know. They wouldn't have a definite socko ending like I was used to reading in the Outdoor Chums at the lake. You know how the Outdoor Chums would end? Always the fun-loving Outdoor Chum, Will, would pick up his paddle, and they would get into the canoe, and standing on the shore would be Ned Chamberlain, the bully, and he would be shaking his fist at the Outdoor Chums. He says, I will get you in the next book, as they paddled towards Lake Winnemahaha. Well, I would know, you know, there was always the end. You could feel the end coming up. But in these, they never quite ended. At least in my mind, I couldn't figure out what the end was about. They would make some comment, and the end. Well, I couldn't stop reading them. So I finished the entire book. Remember, I'm in sixth grade now. How old are you when you're six? Suppose that's a matter of perspective. Well, most people, when they're six, they're 12. I was four. You know, has nothing to do with age. It's an outlook. So I'm reading this book. Well, about halfway through the semester, I decide to make a book report on this. So I write up this whole book report in my typical book report style. This is a very interesting book. It's about this abbess, and it's about this abbey, and they have to stay in this place, and they do some funny stuff, and it was very exciting. And I'm writing all about this, and there are very beautiful pictures that look like they were carved out of wood. And it's just, Miss Robinette, this is the first book I have ever read by a foreigner, and I find they are very interesting writers. This man's name was Boccaccio. And I don't know how you pronounce it because it's got two C's. Yes. Well, I wrote up an entire book report on the Boccaccio, Boccaccio's Decameron. And I was very innocent about it. I just thought it was a book. So I wrote it up. I'm in sixth grade. And I wrote up this one-page book report on this notebook-type paper, you know, with the blue lines that you tear out of the notebook pad that has the Indian head on the cover. And I wrote this whole thing up with ink. That was one requirement. They had to be written in ink because you were also graded on neatness, which meant how many blots that you could not get on the thing, you know, and I'm still going on the slant lines. And I started out by saying, a very interesting book by a foreigner, this man named Boccaccio. And then I described the whole story, and I could not quite get the point of it, you know, but it was very exciting. So I wrote about, it was about the knights, and they were in Italy. It was about all this thing and the nightingales and all this, a very beautiful book. And I go on, I write this whole thing, and all the rest of the kids, that day we hand in our book reports. You know, the kid behind me hands in the book report called Sam the Young Shortstop. You know, another guy hands one in called Black Beauty. Somebody hands one and calls Lassie Returns. And there in the middle of it all is this enigmatic one that's called The Decameron by Boccaccio. Well, I do not know exactly what went through Miss Robinette's mind that night when she is sitting in her pad and she is about to grade the book reports. So I can see her going through, reading about Lassie. Lassie, this is a very interesting book about this dog. This dog that lived on a farm. This dog's name was Lassie. A very exciting book. And then she puts that one aside and writes down there, B+, very good work, Fred. Writes it down. However, you got too many blots. Puts it down. Black Beauty is a very interesting book about this horse. It made me cry. Very good, Annie. That's an excellent book report. C-. You got too many thumbprints. This book is about this abbess and this abbey. They are living at... What? I can see Miss Robinette now, her eyeballs bugging. I can hear her blood pressure going up. After all, it was a chick, you know. She has veins and stuff. And suddenly, obviously, a new picture of that little short kid halfway back in the third row comes into her mind. That one that doesn't say much. The one with the funny look in the eye. Well, the next day, she says, Gene, would you stay a little bit after school? I said, what is this? I figured, you know, I was going to be the thing in the play or something, you know. She says, would you please stay? She said nothing at all about it. Tight-lipped she was throughout the entire day. The kids go out. I'm sitting there. She says, Gene, about your book report. That was a very well-written book report. I said, good. Nobody ever talked about my work. I was strictly a C-plus man all the way through, you know? No one ever said anything about it. They just wrote back, C-plus, sloppy. Or, you know, something like that. C-plus, you copied it. Something like that. So she says, that was very well-written. Did you really enjoy the book? And I said, yes. You know, of course, it was very good. She said, well, I want you to be very truthful with me now. I said, of course, you know, I kid, you know, I'm sitting there. She said, did you read the book? Or did you copy that from somewhere? Or did you hear somebody talk about it? Well, you know, you can't say that you cheated. I said, yes, I read it. He says, where did you get the book? Did you get that out of the library? Did Miss Easter give that to you at the library? Miss Easter was this thin lady that was carved out of a block of Fleischmann's yeast, who was working at the library, and she was born at the age of 72, this lady. She was born with two pairs of rimless glasses already strapped to her head. That's how she hit the earth. Well, she wanted to know where I got that book. She says, did you get that book from Miss Easter? Well, I sensed in the air at that moment, T-R-U-B-L-E-E-E. People know. I says, well, no, a kid gave it to me. A kid gave it to me. Well, because I sensed the stuff going there, you see. I knew that if I said Miss Easter, there would be more notes than you could shake a thing at, you know? And on the other hand, I cannot say, no, I got it at home because I suspected the same thing would happen. I said, a kid gave it to me. A kid. Anybody from the class? No, a kid I met on the playground. A big kid. A big kid gave you that book? That's a big book, isn't it? A thick book? Yes, it's the biggest book I ever read. And a kid gave it to you on the playground. Did he go to this school? Does he go to Harding School? I never saw that kid. No, I don't know where he's from. A big kid. Big kid by the candy store. A big kid by the candy store gave you Boccaccio's Decameron? Well, did he say anything to you? Yeah, he said, here's a book. He said, here's a book, and gave you that book by the candy store? Would you recognize him if you saw him again? Well, it was dark. It was dark. Yeah, it was dark. It was raining. It was dark. Are you telling me the truth? Yeah. Where did you get that book? Home. At home? Do they know you read this book at home? Did you get it at home? Did your mother give it to you? Does your father know you read this? Yeah. Are you sure? Yeah. I'm going to give you a note. And I'm going to call your mother in 1 hour to see whether she got the note. And I'm going to ask her why she gave you that book to read. Okay. Are you telling me the truth? No. Ah. Where did you get the book? My dad's room. Oh. Did he know you took it? No. You know that you did something wrong, don't you?
Yeah.
Did you like the book? Now there was a key question. That was a loaded one.
Yeah.
I see. It was pretty funny, wasn't it?
No.
I was telling the truth. I didn't get a single bop from it. The only thing that had me hung was that it was about all these Italians. And they were in these castles. I couldn't get one single laugh out of it anywhere. And she says, you sure you didn't find it funny anywhere?
No.
She knew I was telling the truth. Well, that's good. That's much better. Now, will you promise me one thing? That you will not sneak into your father's room and get his books out anymore? If I promise one thing, I promise not to send the note home.
Okay.
Now you go on out. Go ahead now. Go on out. And I start to go to the door. And I get about three quarters of the way through the door. And she says, "Oh, Gene." And I said, "What?" Figuring she's about to chicken out on the deal. "Did you read all of it?"
"Yes."
"Well, that's very good. I like to see stick-to-itiveness among the pupils. That is very good. Now, you get out there and play. Okay?" You know, I'm going to tell you something that might surprise you, maybe it won't. But do you know that's the first time I have ever told that story? And I want to tell you another thing. Do you know that, to this very day, nobody knows about that but me and Miss Robinette? That's true. Now you know. Yeah, now you know. But do you know that my mother, if I ever told my mother, even this day, if I call my mother up and say, "Hey, Ma, you remember that? You remember that copy of the Decameron by Boccaccio that the old man used to have?" I could just hear the pregnant pause on the end of the long-distance line. She'd say, "How did you know he had that?" But boy, was that a scarifying moment there. And the odd thing about it was that from that day on, there was a very strange thing. It was a great thing that went on between me and Miss Robinette. It was as though I always felt good in Miss Robinette's class. And we just went right on through. There was never any problems with Miss Robinette. And Miss Robinette, I suppose because she realized that she had this fantastic diabolical secret, and I knew she had this diabolical secret, it went off fine, you know? Nothing was... And one thing I really did learn then, I really, from that day on, stuck to the prescribed book list. No more book reports on G. Aitken's Battle Aces. That was the end of that. But it's funny, that was the first time I became aware of a great world inside of books that was somehow vaguely illicit and yet was not specifically illicit, because at the age of 12 I could tell the real, you know, I mean, you can tell when you're involved in what they call obscenity. But this wasn't at all. They were just good stories. And it took me years. I must have been about 18, maybe 17, 18. I was practically out of high school before I could get up the courage to hunt up a copy of the Decameron and still, incidentally, keep it locked in my high school locker rather than take it home to read, to figure out what all the noise was about. And even then I had trouble. It's, you know, there's some funny things. It's like this woman. Who was it? Did you read that wild comment the other day that was made by some lady, some big lady in the government? I think she's Secretary of the Treasury. She was giving a speech recently. It was reported in all the news. And she was talking about obscenity. And she says that they should have a law, you know, the absolute cut-and-dried law. And she says, "You know, I can't understand," and this is her inexact quote. I'm going to inexactly quote her because it's from memory here. She says, "I can't understand why the lawmakers are having so much trouble defining obscenity. To me, it seems very simple." And I thought, this is one of the most naive statements I've heard coming from a big public figure since some of the wild comments of several late lamented senators. One of the most naive statements I've ever heard in my life. She says, I can't understand. It seems very simple to me. And that is one of the most confusing, not confusing at all, it's one of the most difficult questions to resolve, I think, of all the questions of, how should I say, policy? Believe me. And yet it seems so simple to some people. And this was the first time as a kid that I ran into that wild subtlety, you know, that lies out there, that subtlety that separates, well, I suppose you can say pornography or just plain ordinary stuff from art. That strange in-between gray peculiar world. I was about one of the next great insane moment that I had like that, where I began to see, I suspect that large numbers of people walk through life thinking they understand everything there is to understand. You know? And I find that this is very true. Whenever a person ever questions basic principles and beliefs, immediately you're swamped with tracks. Oh, speaking of tracks, a very significant little item just came out of one of the newspapers. This is from Philadelphia. The item is from Pittsburgh. Don't worry about it. Just everybody be calm. I know exactly where I am. Came out of Pittsburgh. Listen to this one. A Bible-reading man convicted of bank burglary was freed on probation yesterday by a judge who remarked that the sentence was a great exception. Martin Trury, 23, was holding his Bible when he went before the bench of the judge in U.S. District Court in Pittsburgh. He clutched the same Bible last June throughout the trial, which ended when a jury convicted him of chopping into the Manchester office of the Mellon National Bank and Trust Company. Chopped his way right through the wall. Trury had testified that he found the hole in the bank wall and merely entered it to read his Bible, like any good Bible reader will, whenever he finds a hole in the wall of a bank. Police said they also found another Bible in his bag, along with a well-selected set of burglar tools. Interesting. Well, the fascinating thing is they let him go, and they said it's an exception. Many a guy has been able to carry out some wild, fantastic infamy by waving the good book before the crowd as he does it. And by the way, I'm not being anti-religious. I'm being very something else. I have to say that to clear up the air. Speaking of clearing the air here.
Pardon me, sir, but that's a very good-looking blanket you're wearing.
That's my powwow blanket. I wear to go to local Buick dealers, heap big trading powwow.
I see the number 8 woven into the design. Does that mean anything?
Yes.
Do I have to wear a blanket?
Yeah, that old idea of waving the book, you know, is interesting. More than one demagogue has learned that it always works. That if you masquerade as a God-fearing man, you can say pretty nearly anything you want. You'll find this particularly true of Southern demagoguery. As you probably read in some of the speeches in the past year or two. Although it certainly has its place on the halls of Congress. I've seen a few of these little bits go on. You know, speaking of running into that subtlety, let's do this TV thing. They got Jules Verne, The Fabulous World Of, on Channel 9, Channel Whoopi. And while we're on, the next time that I ran into a thing like this, when I began to, I'm always intrigued by people who are able to, there are no problems in their world. Fascinating people. I don't know whether or not they are the most dangerous or the most harmless, because they can be both. Some of the most dangerous people are people who really have answers and proceed to march on that premise, who cannot understand why the rest of the world don't see the obvious answer that they have. It's obvious. And so they march and start blowing people up on that premise. There have been some very interesting things happen over the world on that score. But I've always, in a sense, kind of envied them. You know, this is one of the reasons why artists are continually writing the myth of the noble savage. The noble savage appeals to the artist because the artist is constantly confronted by doubts and conundrums and paradoxes and contradictions in the world that he sees. The noble savage is obviously unaware of all of these. He just is a pre-thought animal, a free spirit moving through a world which sees no confusion or contradiction. And so you'll find many artists secretly admiring prize fighters or thugs or people who solve problems by just hitting other people. It's a sneaky thing, you see. It's a kind of, and yet at the same time, they profess other things in their own writings. And yet they're drawn toward this. I remember another time running into a strange book, and how this strange book came about, how I got it. I found it on a train. I got on a train one day in the Midwest, and I was a young soldier. I had just was coming back from a leave or something. And I found stuck down in the seat this book, and I started to read it. It was just a book, and somebody had torn one of the covers off. An old rotten green cover was torn off, and the book was yellow. It had been wet and everything else. It was just stuck down there. Somebody just threw it away, and I pulled it out, and I started to read this thing. Well, it was the world of mythology. And I began to get sucked into this thing, and the next thing I knew, I began to see some of the things this guy was talking about. And it drew me in like a gigantic whirlpool. And here I am, this PFC, this callow, beardless youth. And more I'm being sucked into this. I didn't know what nine-tenths of the words meant. But I knew there was something going here. There was something bubbling in the pot. This wasn't cream of wheat. Somebody had laced it with something else. It's a book that probably few of you have ever even heard of, a book called Jurgen. J-U-E-R-G-E-N, Jurgen, by James Branch Cobble. And at this time, you see, I was going through my Earl Stanley Gardner phase of literature, you know. And I once in a while would dip in when I'm really doing the serious scene. I would dip into the books of Jack London. And you know, The Call of the North and The Wild Cry of the Wild. And here suddenly I'm involved with the Greek myths. And all kinds of things are going, and people are saying snide things up in the trees, in the hollow trees, and people are doing things. And Queen Guinevere came into it. Wow! You know, it was hard to write my mother after that one.
This is WOR.